The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. If you preferred staying in over the madness of a night out this New Year's Eve, then our interviews this episode are all about you. We're joined by Dr. Marty Laney, psychotherapist and author of The Introvert Advantage. We'll learn why some people's brains may be wired to prefer solitude, and we'll help extroverts learn how to relate to the introverts in their lives. Tonight's show is pre-recorded, so that the team can enjoy their own holiday celebrations, which means we won't be taking questions. Instead, please do enjoy the interview and have a safe and happy new year of your own. And now to Speaking Up. I'm speaking with Barbara Drescher, cognitive psychologist, lecturer on research methods in psychology at California State University, Northridge, and frequent Skeptically Speaking guest because I enjoy her brain. Welcome back, Barb.
Thank you.
So there seem to be a number of different personality tests, from the ones you can do on Facebook to the type that take an hour to finish and at least seem to have some science behind them. So can we safely assume that the aforementioned ones are for entertainment purposes only and just put them aside?
Actually, no, I wouldn't say that. It always bothers me to see those types of measures on Facebook, but not because they're all bunk. I mean, some of them are, obviously. Some of them were made up by some Facebook user. And there are others that are legitimate measures. Unfortunately, these are measures that are given to the public without any context or without any, you know, instructions on how to interpret them. And I think that they not only become overinterpreted or interpreted incorrectly. Just as an example, there's a measure for autistic traits that is not a diagnostic tool. It's autistic traits. It was a personality test. And yet people were taking it as a test for autism, and they were taking issue with the results and picking it apart. And it is a well-established measure, but it's not a test for autism. So I think they become a little misused. But one of the other reasons that it upsets me to see them is the more exposure these tests get, the less valid they become for use in research, because the people who are taking them have already seen them. In some cases, they have opinions about them, and that changes their answers.
Let's leave those aside for a moment, even though I didn't realize that there was any validity to those, and maybe I'm going to have to relook at those. But let's talk specifically about the types that seem to have a lot of thought put into them. I'd like to know if they're evidence-based. So which ones would fall into that category? I'm thinking of things like Myers-Briggs.
Definitely the Myers-Briggs. That's an old measure. It's been around for a very long time. It's very well tested. It's very reliable, and it's very valid for what it is testing. There are other tests that, like the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, that are actually used for diagnosis. But that's a different type of test than the Myers-Briggs. There are tests like the Big Five. There are tests that are based on the five-factor theory of personality that are well-established, very reliable, valid measures. But then there are a whole set of tests for individual personality traits, many of them, and there are more being developed all the time. Because there are so many personality traits, and we want sensitive measures, individual tests for individual traits. And some of them are actually fairly short, but they're well-tested. We look for two things when we test any psychological test. We look for validity and reliability. Validity really refers to the extent to which a test measures what it sets out to measure. If, for example, I set out to measure something like reading comprehension, I wouldn't actually have the participants count the number of letters in a paragraph. I've seen students use this their first time in research, and they'd say, well, count the number of F's. You've probably seen those paragraphs where they say, well, count the number of F's, and you miss the F's in of and some of the smaller words that we skip over. But that's not reading comprehension, is it? It's you're not reading, and you're not really comprehending it. That's not the goal of the task. So that wouldn't be a very good measure of reading comprehension. But it is a reliable test. It's probably going to test the same thing in every person that takes the test. It's probably going to test the same thing in every environment that you administer the test. It's probably going to test the same thing every time you give the test. So it could be a reliable test, but not a valid test. It could be a valid test and not a reliable test. We need both of them in order to have a good test.
Well, how are tests like the Myers-Briggs or the five-factor tests developed then? And if you could give me lots of details, please, because personality tests often feel vaguely like horoscopes for me.
They're not that different in the outcome, but you are getting real information and you're making real information from it. It's just very vague. These tests are usually developed, they're called measures. In research, we call them measures because they measure something. And when we conduct research, we're usually looking for the answer to a question that has to do with how one variable is related to another variable. And in order to find that out, we have to know what the values, those variables are in a sample that we choose. So we have to measure them. So we start with the definition of what we want to measure. And then we take that definition and construct what seems to tap into that measure. And those things can be many different things that kind of converge to one. For example, something like extroversion has to do with more than just how outgoing you are. There are lots of adjectives that you can think of to describe someone who is extroverted. They might be gregarious, they might be bubbly, but several of those things together kind of cluster together to make this construct called extroversion. So it's constructed of several things. A lot of the variables that we test in psychology are what we call latent variables. They're not things that we can measure directly. We can't take out a yardstick or a measuring tape and say, okay, well, it's 12 meters long. We can't look at someone's brain or even the byproducts of that brain and know exactly what the value of that measure is. So I can't crack open your head and know, well, she's depressed at this level. So I have to construct a definition of that that allows me to measure it. And that definition could be a self-report test. It could be a number of measures. It could be someone else judging you. And these personality tests, they start with the definition of what is it exactly that we're trying to measure? And then what do we mean when we say that? So that's helping to define it. Okay, what questions do we have to ask in order to find that out? And then you also have to build in things like self-report bias. How much are people willing to tell you, even if it's anonymous? How much are people understanding of their own behavior, attitude, whatever it is that you're measuring? Some measures you can't really ask people directly how they feel about something because they don't really know. So a lot of the measures that we use are not exactly questions about how you feel or what you're thinking or what you would even do in a specific situation, but they're questions designed to find that out.
So then what kind of research are these tests built on?
I wouldn't say they're actually built on research. They are research.
A form of research in themselves, right.
Exactly. We have a definition and we build it on the definition. And then we test them to find out if indeed we have measured what we defined.
So things like the Myers-Briggs or the Big Five, so what do they measure?
Well, that's the interesting thing, I think. You might be surprised to know that most of them actually measure preferences. If you've taken one, and most people have, I think, you'll notice that most of the questions are, I prefer to be alone. I prefer to go to a party. Or some of them are forced choice. You're given two statements and you have to choose between them. Those are preferences, but none of them measure behavior. That's one thing that is really important to keep in mind is they're often sold that way. I think it's funny that retailers will use them all the time. I remember being a 19-year-old, very naive, and applying for a job to sell jewelry. And they put me through a battery of tests. And this was a widely known national company. And they had every employee do this. And the idea was that they would prevent theft if they knew more about you, about your psychological makeup. But these tests can't do that because our behavior is actually driven much more by situational factors than it is by dispositional factors. And personality is disposition. It doesn't say much about the choices that you would necessarily make in any given situation because we're talking about very complex variables. Life is not simple. your personality is not simple. It's made up of probably hundreds of traits, not just five. And the situations that you're in are different from day to day. And what we have found from lots and lots of social research is that situations can be extremely powerful. We actually talked about this the last time I was on the show with the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Right.
That's one of those studies that has shown us that situations can be extremely powerful. I mean, all appearances would say that all of these men who were in this study were pretty much the same. They were all put through a battery of psychological tests, and none of them really stood out as being, you know, unstable in any way or different from anyone else. And yet, based on the roles they were assigned in a make-believe prison situation, which they all knew was make-believe, they behaved very differently. So these tests don't predict behavior. That doesn't mean they're not reliable. They're reliable because they tend to stand up over time. And they tend to stand up in different situations. They tend to measure the same thing time after time after time. And they're measuring something that is fairly stable across your lifespan. And it doesn't mean they're not valid. They're valid because they measure what they say they're going to measure. But they don't measure behavior.
Well, this is what I'm wondering, because I took the Myers-Briggs test when I was younger and then again recently, and I got two different results. So why would that be?
There's two reasons. Just because we say they're stable traits doesn't mean that they are 100% always stable. People do change. They don't change drastically overnight, and they don't change at their core makeup. But traits can change. Traits can certainly change. And, you know, like I said, you're made up of probably hundreds of traits, not just, you know, four. But also because you may have been somewhere, you know, kind of on the line on one or two of those measures. The Myers-Briggs is called a typer. It actually puts you into 16 different categories based on your answers on four different dimensions. So those dimensions are actually things that are across a spectrum. So, you know, an introvert or an extrovert, a thinker, a feeler, you know, all the dimensions on the Myers-Briggs, they're continuums. People don't actually fall into one side or the other unless we draw a line somewhere. So the researchers have said, well, we're going to call everybody who's on this side of the line that, and everybody's on the other side of the line something else. And so you've now taken this wealth of information and you have lost most of it by just putting people into two boxes. And so all those people on the fence, you know, that are kind of in the middle, they can kind of shift back and forth very easily. And it doesn't take much to move from one side or the other with the answer on one question. So it's not unusual to see some slight changes across your lifespan on measures that are typers. These types don't tell us a whole lot, though. I mean, you wouldn't take 100 people and divide them into 16 categories based on their appearance.
Right.
So it makes absolutely no sense to say, well, your disposition is this one type, and then there's only 16 of them. It isn't very useful information. It's the descriptions you get are, they have to be very vague.
So I guess this is what I'm wondering then. What are these tests useful for then?
It depends on the test. I think that they're fun for people. I don't think that they tell you much about yourself, especially not more than you already knew. It's a little like getting a horoscope when you look at a type, because you're getting an output that's vague enough that it could fit many, many people, because it has to be. That's all that was measured. It was something very vague. And then it was kind of condensed and collapsed into these 16 different things. But you kind of know where you are on most of those things. I think that it is interesting, though, for some people to see how they fall in relation to other people, especially when you look at individual trait measures. Individual trait measures can be very, very useful because they do correlate with some behaviors and they correlate with some attitudes. For example, I've done some research on academic entitlement, how it correlates to things like rehearsal learning strategies, like rote memorization, flashcard usage, that sort of thing, and attribution for one's successes, academic successes in particular. And what we discovered was that people who are very high on entitlement attitudes also tend to use rehearsal learning strategies, rote memorization, that sort of thing. And then they also tend to attribute their failures, their academic failures, to outside forces. Things like luck, the teacher, the material, and not to their own learning strategies. Well, what's very interesting about that is that it's also very, very, very highly correlated with a personality trait called narcissism. So when you measure narcissism by itself, you get a very sensitive measure. There is a level of narcissism. There's a value on that that ranges. And that variability can be used to show a high correlation with things like academic entitlement. When you break things up into categories, you lose a lot of information. But when you measure things by themselves and you leave all of that variability in there, you get a more sensitive measure, and then you can see how it's related to other traits. And that can be very useful. It can be useful in designing curriculum and policies to address some of the problems that we have with entitlement and the way students learn, because that's only harmful to the way they learn. What happens is they end up in this loop. They attribute all their failures to external factors, so they never change their behavior. And if they never change their behavior, then they never succeed.
So would somebody be able to do that looking at the Myers-Briggs test then? Would someone be able to see something in themselves and change their behavior then?
I don't think so. The Myers-Briggs it's 16 categories, and none of them really tell you anything negative about yourself. It's more of a description of who you are, and that doesn't tell you a lot about an individual trait. Even something like the big five, the five factor theories, tend to be, you take one large test and it gives you a value on a spectrum for five different measures. So you're actually looking at separate traits and you're looking at a more varied value, you know, low or high in something. But that doesn't tell you whether those traits are good or bad. It doesn't tell you what's correlated with them. Narcissism's probably highly correlated with something that's very positive or very helpful in one's life as well. And it's a personality trait. It's not something that you're necessarily going to be able to change very easily. We know that pretty well from personality disorders. And that's another thing. Those individual trait measures tend to correlate very highly with personality disorders. When people go off the scale on one, that's not a diagnostic measure by itself, but it does tend to be highly correlated. And so with other measures, we can kind of safely say, yes, this person has a personality disorder. And the word disorder is thrown in there because they are impaired. If they were not impaired, we wouldn't call it a disorder. So individual traits can be harmful. They can be helpful on either end. But you really have to know in what ways in order to change your behavior. And what we learned from personality disorders is that they're highly resistant to treatment. Personality doesn't change very easily. And that's actually by definition. Personality is defined as stable traits. So you may work very hard at changing something that is stable within you, but it's not easy.
I'm stuck on where this would be useful then. You and I have spoken on air and off air about the soft sciences versus the hard sciences. And I feel like this is one of those areas that make people feel like psychology isn't as solid. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're probably right. I think people tend to read into these measures more than what's there. If they take a measure that says that they are open to new experiences, for example, that's a personality trait, or very low on that, they tend to think of themselves as being closed-minded, and that's going to drive all of their behaviors. And that's not necessarily the case. It doesn't necessarily say whether you do take risks or not. It might say that you don't prefer to take risks. It's not that you won't. It's that you prefer not to. And so it doesn't say much about your behavior. And I think that also there's the stigma attached to some of these, that it somehow defines who you are. And I think that your actions define more of who you are than your personality, you know, measures. So I think that people read into them more than what they're meant to measure. And a lot of that is simply that they're not designed to be given to lay people to tell them about themselves. They're designed for researchers to use because, you know, as I said before, we can't crack open your head and measure it. So that's really what they're designed for. And when we keep in mind what the purpose is, then we can actually interpret it correctly. But if you don't have the training in the background, it's really easy to look at an outcome and to take offense with it or to be proud of something that doesn't really say much. or to think that it drives your behavior. And I think that it could drive your behavior, actually. So I think there's a danger there. And it does make social science look soft, because how many times have you gotten the outcome of something like that and said, that's not me?
Often.
Yeah. And it may or may not be. Keep in mind that often it's also given out of context. So the outcome may not be what it would have been had it been administered the way it was meant to be administered. But even if it was, it may be you, but you may be looking at it or reading it, interpreting it in a way that it wasn't meant to be interpreted.
Right. Barb, as always, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes, and while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Dr. Marty Laney, a researcher, educator, and psychotherapist. She's also one of the foremost authorities on introversion. She's the author of The Hidden Gifts of the Introverted Child, The Introvert and Extrovert in Love, and The Introvert Advantage. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Dr. Laney.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start out by saying the basic definition of an extrovert.
We're born with two basic systems, and one is to manage the outside world and one's to manage the inside world. And extroverts are more dominant on the system that's focusing on the outside world. So they get energy and are interested in the outside world, and that's how their temperament is more balanced on that side of the temperament continuum. It's kind of like being left or right-handed. So they're born kind of being, let's say, right-handed and less focused on the internal world.
Are the qualities of introversion and extroversion more fundamental or consistent than other personality traits?
Yes, it's found to be the most fundamental over time of any of the personality traits that they study. And they, believe me, they study all types of personality traits or behaviors. But the evolutionary psychologists think that we're born with some of this innate, so that we don't have quite so much to learn when we come into the world, because our brains still have a lot more that we need to learn. And we have fundamental, like basic survival abilities, and temperament is one of them. If you're an extrovert and an emergency happens, you tend to run toward or do something. Introverts tend to pull back, withdraw, and kind of watch and see what's happening. Those are just fundamental differences in people.
So what would the difference be between temperament and personality then?
They can tell now when children are either more introverted or extroverted as young as, they say, about 4 months. And introverted children or babies are called owls, because they tend to be quite alert, don't move their bodies as much, look around, take in a lot. Very often you'll hear parents say that about a child. Oh, they're an old soul, or there's something about them. And extroverted babies tend to be a lot more active and maybe in alert states when something's happening, but not necessarily in alert states when nothing much is going on near them. So personality is where humans have all kinds of traits and abilities and shortcomings and behaviors and characteristics, and all of that together is a personality, which includes one's temperament. There's, I'm sure you know, something called the Big Five personality traits.
Right.
They're kind of overarching, or there's now the Big Seven. And included in that is the introversion and extroversion, because it is so central to how you respond and how you get your energy and how you interact with other people. Introversion and extroversion affect a lot of your life, way more than people realize, actually. But personality is really each unique individual's collection of all kinds of aspects of themselves.
Well, I've read quite a few books on psychology, and something that comes up frequently is the assertion that people are very hard to classify in terms of personality types. Would you agree?
Well, yes and no. I mean, as we're finding with genetics now, I just got a postgraduate certificate in genetics because I'm interested in genetics after working so much on temperament. And the humans behave in clusters. So we and genes come in clusters on certain chromosomes. So obviously we can in some ways classify people. That's what we do when we diagnose people. It gives us an idea, for instance, if someone has a hysterical personality or a narcissistic personality, they can look almost identical. However, as a therapist, you need to treat each very differently, so you better know what the differences are. So humans do behave in certain patterns and clusters of traits and patterns. I can pretty much guess by knowing some things about someone, some other aspects that they might have. And at the other end of that continuum is that each person's unique and can surprise you.
So then what can things like the Myers-Briggs test and the Big Five, how much can they really tell us about someone then?
Humans are not black and white. Everything in the human body brain is on continuums. Everything about us is on continuums. Myers-Briggs, I actually think, is amazing in what it captures about some people. It captures enough to kind of have ideas in general about approaching people while staying open, one of the Big Five traits, to being able to see other aspects. Like, I work with a lot of people and we guess what their boss is like, and then we talk about how you approach that kind of person. And I've, in 30 years of being a therapist, never seen it not help. So there are certain things that you can see about people which helps you interact with them more skillfully. You know what, Jung and all these early theorists were very brilliant observers, and while they didn't have the brain neuroscience knowledge that we have today, they pretty well captured the various larger chunks of the brain and how each works. And that's why there is a certain validity, realizing that people can at certain times be surprising or not follow what their usual personality might be, or they might be able to grow aspects of their personality more. I'm very introverted. I still have to work on being more extroverted. It'd be kind of hard to do all the book tours I've done unless I understood how to manage myself and help myself extrovert more.
So you're saying it is possible to change these essential parts of your personality?
No, I wouldn't say change. You can't change temperament. It's like being right or left-handed. You're going to function best wherever your natural set point is on the introversion-extroversion scale. You know, like mine's way over on the introverted side. I still function best when I'm working around that, what they call comfort zone. But I have to learn, as all introverts do, to move into doing more extroverting, moving down the continuum toward more extroverting. And I can do that as long as I'm very careful about storing up energy, not overdoing, taking breaks, things that helps my body and brain work better. But I'll still function better, closer to my own set point.
Now, you say that you must do this, and one of the things that you write about is that the world around us is extroverted. Can you explain that?
Well, research shows around the world, and even though I know some people in the Myers-Briggs world think that extroversion and introversion is more 50-50, I personally don't. I think in today's world is so manic that people may look more introverted or need more downtime, but I still think that about 75% of people are extroverted. That's shown over in every country over time, because really you need more of those action-oriented folks that like to go out and have wars and things, and they get killed off more too. So it makes sense that the kind of more inward people that are maybe planning the strategy for the war, sitting back in their bunker, We don't need as many of those. So I do think, and certainly in the United States, extroversion is very much idealized. And so people, you know, grow up thinking that they should be extroverted, which is very hard on introverts, unfortunately. And they really do think something's wrong with them. And most of our education, most of our jobs, certainly, are really made for more extroverted types of people with a lot of energy who can work long hours and very hard on introverts.
Well, you say that for a long time, the cultural and even the scientific assumption was that extroverted qualities are positive and introverted qualities are negative. So where does that idea come from, specifically the scientific angle?
Well, actually, it's a funny kind of ideology. From Freud worked with Jung and Adler, who were two major theorists around the same period of time that he was working, and he and Jung worked together especially quite a bit. And then, of course, like most people with Freud, they had a falling out, both Adler and Jung. And Freud saw Jung and Adler as introverts, which they were, and Freud was more of an extroverted guy. So he began, after their big falling out, he began writing about introverts as negative. And that's really how it sort of began. And that the confusion, you know, like when people are psychotic, they will often say they were introverted because psychotic people withdraw, yes, but that's not the same as being an introvert. And so there's a lot of confusion about what introversion is. But what's really fascinating, and I want to write an article about this, is that of late, lots of research under psychopaths, which I've been interested in studying, psychopathology, and other narcissism, for instance, that those personalities, extroversion is part of the underlying aspects of those diagnoses. So that while it's true people can be too inward if they have a brain illness, they can also be too outward, and that can be a brain illness too.
Right.
And they don't get much press on the extroverted side. But you see loner in the paper all the time.
Oh, yes, we do.
Loner. Big difference between being introverted and being completely isolated and cut off from other people.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we're discussing introversion with Dr. Marty Laney, author of The Introvert Advantage, How to Thrive in an Extrovert World. So you mentioned that introverts get their energy internally and that extroverts get it externally. We're not talking scientifically that this is energy.
It's physiologically.
Okay.
We get energy from food that we eat, and we get energy from whatever neurotransmitters we're dominant on. And there's different types of energy. There's physical energy, emotional energy, intellectual energy. And those are different for different people. And extroverts run much more on dopamine, which is the major reward neurotransmitters. For a lot of introverts, dopamine feels like we've had too much caffeine, too jangly, too uncomfortable. But that same amount of dopamine for an extrovert could feel great, and they feel energized and raring to go because they're on that side of the system that uses dopamine a lot.
How is this researched exactly?
Well, there's absolutely, when I first took the Myers-Briggs in college and realized I wasn't very introverted, which explained a lot of peculiarities about me that I didn't understand at the time. And then when I was began working with people and got a lot of introverted clients, I noticed how much they had certain struggles that were very similar to mine. And was kind of puzzled because it seemed so physiological to me. So I put in introversion in the UCLA library catalog and got like 5,000 hits of studies around the world, and at that time way more in other countries than the United States. There's more research in the United States, but there's also more acknowledgement about temperament in other countries. So there's lots of research about introversion and extroversion. What they've done with some of the brain scan work is that they can track which pathways introverts and extroverts tend to use more. There's also lots of studies done on energy and physical differences between introverts and extroverts, because all of that is very, very affected on what neurotransmitters you have more or less of.
So maybe give me an example of what would cause more blood flow in an introvert than an extrovert.
Well, what Dr. Johnson found at Yale was that the introverts were using one of the major pathways used by acetylcholine in the brain, and it's a very long pathway in the brain, and it's meant to be used for really being able to focus and study something for a long time, and that it's also involved in the parasympathetics. It runs the parasympathetic side of the nervous system, which is what's called the rest and digest side of the nervous system. So it keeps us on the side of the nervous system so that our body's much more still and our brains are very active. Extroverts, on the other hand, they use one of the major dopamine pathways. It's a shorter pathway in their brain. It moves from thing to thing quite easily. It doesn't focus as much. And their body is dominant on the sympathetic side of the nervous system, which is made for action. So the brain's always choosing, should we take action or should we sit and think? And so the problem is that introverts, and I have that problem myself, once I've researched something and put it together, it doesn't really matter to me too much if I actually do anything with it in the outside world.
And right.
Like my first book, my therapist that I was seeing at the time for the program I was in at school said, you know, you should write a book about this, and really it hadn't occurred to me, although I'm glad I did, from the standpoint that it's really helped a lot of people, which I feel good about. But it would be a very different motivation than someone who does something in order to show it in the outside world more, which is a more extroverted motivation.
Well, extroverts and introverts also react differently to different stimulation. Why do the former experience more understimulation, whereas the latter frequently feel overstimulated?
Well, they found that in all sensory systems, they understand that there's a lot of different memory systems, there's different pathways for the auditory system, for the visual system. Sometimes there's three pathways, but usually they found that there's two, and one is quick and picks up, let's say visual system picks up movement, or the auditory system picks up a sound. Those are generally hooked up to a more extroverted side of your brain and your body. The introverted side is a slower pathway that actually takes in a lot more, but it's unconscious, and it will take a while for it to reach consciousness. So introverts are taking in way more, and way more than they may appear to be taking in, and sometimes way more than they realize they're taking in. And then they need to process that in order to break it down and break it into smaller bits so that they can do something with it. Without really realizing it, they're getting overwhelmed by all that information. Extroverts register things and then, boom, they move on. There isn't the same amount of information to process. Also, when you think about the fact that everything extroverts do in the outside world gives them energy, gives them stimulation, gives them energy, and everything in the outside world drains energy for introverts. If you really take that in and think about it, it's a huge difference between people. My husband and I wrote my third book on our marriage, which he's an extrovert and I'm an introvert. And he was thinking it would be pretty easy to work with me on the book and watch me, you know, write the first two books. But after he started actually doing it, where you have to sit for hours and write, he had quite a realization that that was really hard for him to do. So he would write, or we would discuss something, I would write it up, then we would discuss it some more. Meanwhile, he's going out to do errands, going out to talk to people, going out to do various things that he does on boards of companies and all, and then coming back. And after a while, he said, I could never sit for 8 hours like you do and write. It would be impossible. That's a big difference between introverts and extroverts.
Depth and breadth are two concepts that you use to illustrate the differences between these two extremes. How do these terms help explain the introverted and the extroverted approaches to knowledge and to experience?
Those pathways in the brain that actually a lot of extroverts can look like very good students because they can learn things quickly and spit them out quickly. However, if they're asked later, 6 months later or a year later, the knowledge was never integrated because it's a very take it in, spit it out, and it may or may not really get integrated into their long-term memory. Introverts, on the other hand, are slower to take in things and then mull them over and integrate them, and they need time to do that. And then it gets stored because we're dominant in long-term memory. And then they need to learn to retrieve things, which is really important. Lots of introverts think it, that they don't know anything until you start teaching them how to retrieve their memories, and then they actually usually have quite good memories and integrate a lot and have a lot of knowledge if they can retrieve it and if there's time and not pressure. So the silly idea that people have that being smart is doing things quickly, which is really a problem, is unfortunate, because actual wisdom is developed by reflection and being able to stop and integrate and mull things over.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we're talking to psychotherapist Marty Laney about introversion. Well, let's talk about the D4DR gene. And you pointed out the long and short versions of this gene seem to correspond to behaviors very similar to extroversion and introversion.
Well, one aspect of it, they're now finding more and more specific genes that have to do with affecting acetylcholine, affecting other neurotransmitters that affect whether a person's more introverted or extroverted. But the D4DR is a dopamine gene, and it promotes a lot of activity and variety in people, but in an extroverted way. So it's variety in the outside world, like enjoying bungee jumping and stuff like that. A lot of very active sports, people have long D4DR genes, which is connected to what I said earlier about how, you know, we think of all these things as being similar, but actually they aren't. That the same amount of dopamine, it's just like caffeine. If some people drink a cup of coffee with caffeine in it, they don't ordinarily drink it, it can make them very nervous, anxious, maybe even irritable, not sleep. Other people, it doesn't affect too much. So it's the same thing with all of our neurotransmitters. And dopamine can be an unpleasant feeling for some people. And others, if they have a longer D4DR gene, they're more comfortable with a lot of dopamine.
There's more science to this than I had realized. Most of us have heard the term left-brained and right-brained. But what are the differences between the two sides, and how does this affect behavior, and why did I think this was bunk?
Well, again, it's a continuum. The human brain works, has functional areas. So there are functional areas that we can separate, the front and the back of the brain, the right and the left side, the top and the bottom. Those are the six major kind of functional areas of the brain that scientists chop the brain up into for different kinds of functions. On the other hand, the brain is also discrete, and the more mature a person is and the better developed they are, their brain is wired up to work together in different areas so that they can work together. But the brain is also made to turn areas off and turn areas on, so that anytime anything in the brain is working in one area, it's going to be turning off something in another area, because we can't have the whole brain working at once. That's really what schizophrenia is. There's too many cells firing all at once, and we're not meant to do that. That's too much an overload for people. So the right brain is dominant in infants until they're about between 2 to 3 years old, and it's what we call the unconscious. It doesn't have language. It's the part of the brain that takes in a lot of information, and the information has to go across to the left brain, which comes on board much more around 2 to 3 years when you start to see the child beginning to get language, because the left side of the brain is where we have language stored in various areas, and so we have to collect verbs and nouns and stuff in order to make a sentence, and we have to collect sounds in order to make a word. So those more conscious aspects of us are on the left side of the brain. The left brain also sifts and sorts and is rather rigid and linear and throws things out. So most people are more dominant on the left side of the brain. It's run by primarily major neurotransmitters, again, are dopamine. So if you have an introvert, this is more of a stereotypical introverted person that tends to be kind of quiet, more serious, withdrawn, and, quote, logical, unquote. They tend to be more of a left brain introvert, and they usually have more energy than the right brain introvert. Right brain introverts are people that are good at picking up emotions in others, emotions in themselves. They can talk about their internal world really well if they're comfortable with someone. And they also sometimes tend to have trouble finding words because it has to go across the bridge and find words.
Right.
So that takes time, and if they're nervous, that's more difficult to do. They're usually intelligent, but in a way that doesn't show up in school. They usually do better in college than in other grades. And very intuitive kind of people. I'm a right brain introvert. You know, it's even more a difficult kind of introvert to be, though, than a left brain introvert.
One of the things that you mentioned that I actually found curious was that being shy is not the same as being introverted.
Not at all, no. There is some genetic findings with shyness now, but shyness is not a temperament. Shyness can be learned, and certainly introverts, extroverts can be shy. If they're criticized a lot, they can end up shy. But shyness, with introverts, the thing that is very puzzling to usually themselves and to other people is how much they can change, in that if I'm talking with my best friend and we're jabbering away for several hours, no one would look at me and think I'm an introvert. If I go to a party, however, I find it hard to think of anything to say. So in different environments, we react differently. Shyness is across the board. A shy person can be shy with one person. They can be shy with someone they've known a long time. They can be shy. And usually they don't have very good social skills, and often shyness can be helped a lot with better social skills. Introverts usually have quite good social skills. It's just that our brain is made for one-on-one conversation and a deeper, more complex conversation, whereas extroverts are made for social chit-chat, and there's actually different pathways in the brain for those different kinds of conversing. And shy people are usually quite anxious and fearful, and I've worked with a lot of extroverted people that are shy, and it's really, really horrible for them, because here they are needing energy from being out with other people. They want to be out with other people, and yet they're horribly shy. I mean, that's a really difficult place to be. But they can usually be helped a lot by learning more skills and by practicing going out in the world.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're talking to researcher and psychotherapist Dr. Marty Laney about the science behind being an introvert and how we can apply that to navigating in an extrovert world. And we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll discuss the science of parenting with Dr. John Medina. His book, Brain Rules for Baby, examines some of the most basic things that science understands about the developing brain and provides helpful strategies for encouraging your child's mental growth. What effect does TV really have on the infant mind? How does a child's happiness influence her intelligence? And we'll start the hour talking science, technology, and raising curious kids with Geek Dad Jason Cranford Teague. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking today with Dr. Marty Laney, researcher, educator, and psychotherapist, and author of The Hidden Gifts of the Introverted Child, The Introvert and Extrovert in Love, and The Introvert Advantage, How to Thrive in an Extrovert World. So introverts and extroverts, from what we've discussed, have very different needs and considerations biologically. And not surprisingly, communication problems are the result quite often. So what's the most important thing for introverts to remember when communicating with extroverts then?
Well, first of all, they need to be sure that their energy is stored up so that they have some energy. They need to speak in shorter sentences, quicker pace than they would ordinarily, and lean forward if they're across the desk from someone or at a meeting. Introverts very often sit back and kind of gear themselves up for talking in that way for a short amount of time. They won't really be able to keep that up for a long time, but for at least some amount of time, they can. And another important thing to say to extroverts for introverts is, well, I'm thinking that over, or I'm thinking that that's a good question. Let me get back to you, or I'll send you an email later. Because extroverts think that if introverts are not talking, they're not thinking, because that's the way their system works. They think and talk at the same time, and they don't necessarily, like a lot of extroverts have said to me, you mean you can decide what you're going to actually say? Because they often get their foot in their mouth because they say whatever they're thinking. And whereas we're, you know, more on the inhibited side of the nervous system, so we usually consider what we're going to say before we say it. Very different kind of interacting. So it's important for introverts to kind of indirectly educate extroverts about how introverts work.
But just to clarify for the audience, we're not saying that introverts think better.
They don't think better. However, they certainly have the ability to have very complex thinking. So that research shows that the more gifted someone is, the more introverted they are, because that's just the pathways they're using in the brain. I'd always think a good example is that two of our smartest presidents, Jimmy Carter, very, very introverted. You can take a nap in between his sentences. He speaks very slowly, but he's got a real internal compass about his values and how he is, and is a very deep thinker. Bill Clinton is very extroverted, brilliant, speaks very well, very knowledgeable in lots of ways. However, not as integrated a person in his knowledge or his ability to apply that knowledge, but extremely knowledgeable. So they're good examples of two very intelligent people that are one more extroverted, one more introverted.
So then it would be fair to say that we definitely need each other at this point.
Yes, we do need each other, and that both types of intelligence are very valuable, but they are very different.
So one of the things that you wrote about was the fact that concentration is easily lost by introverts, and at that point it can be difficult to get back. So do you have some strategies around that?
Again, we use one of the longest pathways that goes through the brain up to the frontal part of the brain to be able to concentrate deeply on something. So once you're using that pathway and you get interrupted, there's a very small area in the brain that some people call the executive secretary area of the brain. There's different titles for it. Unfortunately, brain researchers tend to name things what they want to name them, so it makes it very confusing. But you have to be able to go back up and get into that area of the brain again. And so when we're interrupted, it's very difficult to re-enter that. And it helps introverts to realize why they get sort of irritated about being interrupted, and that it's important, if you're really going to be concentrating on something, to not have interruptions for a certain amount of time. That was a real bone of contention with my husband and I. He really didn't understand why, you know, he couldn't just walk in and start talking to me. And he likes that when people do that, you know, when he's at work, his door is open. when I'm at work, my door's closed. Because to him, it's like, oh boy, some stimulation's coming in from the outside. And he can go back to what he was working on. But for me, it's like, oh, shoot, I was just near putting a bunch of complex things together, and I was interrupted, and now it's not clear to me again. I'm going to have to work to get back to that place again.
So what kind of strategies, then, can people use besides the barring of your door?
Well, I do recommend that people at work have signs on their door, you know, like with a little clock on it that says, I'll be available at 10:15, or leave me a note and I'll get back to you, or shoot me an email and I'll let you know if they need to concentrate on something. Bullpen work environments are really difficult for introverts, where there's a lot of noise and a lot of other people around, that they may need to go and found some quieter place that they can go to if they need to concentrate on something. And I think explaining it to people is really where introverts, they don't do that very much, and they really need to say, you know, I know you would like some ideas about this. I'll really need to give it some really good attention for a couple of hours, and then I'll get back to you. Because it's really important to do that with extroverts, to tell them that.
What's the most important thing that introverts need to realize about themselves in order to increase their own satisfaction with their lives?
Well, I really think they need to get a good grasp of how their temperament works. Because once you get a good understanding of it, a lot of introverts go, oh my God, that's exactly what happens. But they've never seen it put together in a whole picture before. And once you get that, then you can be a lot more confident and strategize for yourself a lot better than when you keep thinking something's wrong with you, or you shouldn't be that way, or you try hard to be different. It helps them learn to pace themselves and really to feel okay, so that if somebody else is critical of them for being slow or being too quiet or not contributing, they don't take it in.
Well, then maybe since there's more extroverts than there are introverts, what would you really like to tell extroverts about dealing with the minority?
Well, I think it's very understandable why they find introverts puzzling, in that we shift from different parts of ourselves and that we don't feed their system very well of stimulation. So that it's understandable that they have difficulties with us. However, really important for them to realize that introverts have a lot of good ideas. They're very creative generally. They're very smart ordinarily. And that they can contribute a lot if extroverts can kind of slow down and appreciate another way that the brain works. You know, they can be the salesman in the company, but somebody's got to be back at the office keeping the compass and the strategy of the company grounded. I mean, you don't see many ads in our papers that say ingoing employees wanted.
I think everybody should go hug an introvert right now. If they're into that.
Absolutely, because, man, you see what happens when you get too many extroverts. You get big, fat problems.
Thanks very
much. As you would if you had too many introverts, too.
Absolutely. Dr. Laney, thanks very much for being here. And it's,
oh, thanks so much.
The Introvert Advantage is an amazing book, and I very, very, very much, and I'll say very one more time, very much suggest this to anybody who is an introvert and is having trouble with that or just wants to know the science behind their brains.
Yeah.
And Dr. Laney's website is theintrovertadvantage.com, and we posted the link on our site, skepticallyspeaking.com. There are also links to our Facebook page, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and
witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.